From Butch HQ on Riverside Avenue in multi-channel, multicultural Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk gaming and game development. I'm Martha McGarry, and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Martha Croy, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are audio basics and representation in games. And so, if everyone is ready,
let's start. That's the that's just the number, or
oh yeah.
Okay, we gotta get these choppier. Come on. 118. The episode. Yeah.
Woo! You did it.
Our 118th episode. Is there any special to that number, or just
I don't know.
You just had a little stroke there.
118.
Yeah.
It's cool.
I know. Sure. Every number has some meaning in video game.
It's like, true. January 18th is 118.
I don't know where I'm going with this.
Welcome to the numerology with Steve McGregor.
He'll tell your fortune based on...
We're going to hit 120 pretty soon. That's a round number and a nice marker.
Is. Yes.
On our way to 200.
Yeah.
So, speaking of numbers and dates, there's a date that is important to you.
Yes. So, Treasure Stack will be coming out March 1st.
What?
Yes.
Whoa.
Yay. Yes.
That might be soon.
All right.
It'll be out on Xbox, Switch, and PC. This is the game I've been working on. I get paid to work on. So that's what that is.
Holy bolts. I did the calendar math. That's in a couple of days, listeners.
Whoa. So
it'll be this Friday.
Hey, yes. Yeah, that is Friday. Yes. So look forward to that. You know, let me know if you played it and liked it. And if there's bugs, tell me that.
We want a report from every single listener that you played it.
Yes.
And you purchased a copy.
Right.
Don't play your buddies. Purchase your own copy.
Right. Exactly. I need all of those details.
Or we will revoke your clubhouse membership.
Ooh, we should make patches and like stuff that are like Nice Games Club member or whatever.
Should do that though. I wanted to do that for a while. That just makes, because then like honorary clubhouse member.
Yeah.
That'd be really cute.
Well, if listeners, if there's anything that like that, that you'd, because we've talked about that in the past, like some merch of some kind.
Yeah.
Is there anything you want from us? Let us know. We'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. We're desperate to do it.
But anyway, that's distraction.
Yeah.
Yes.
Treasure Stack.
Treasure Stack's coming out in 2 days, apparently.
So,
or 3 days.
Steven, can you give us like the condensed history of you with Treasure Stack? Listeners have not, maybe not all of them have heard the whole story.
Yes. Okay. So I got hired at this place 11 months. Oh, at this point, it's March. So about 11 months ago. It was kind of a surprise. I got there and I was like, oh, I'm going to be working on web browser games. It'll be great. I get to experiment with all these small games. It'll be nice. And then my boss came in. He's like, surprise, you're working on Treasure Stack. It's not a web browser game, y'all. It's a big console game.
And you had played the game here at Glitch at a playtest event, right?
Yes, exactly. I knew what it was, and but I didn't know that I was going to be the one working on it. I thought other people were working on it or something like that.
And the one working on it is right.
Yes. Right. I was the sole developer on it for a long time. And so what I did was I rebuilt basically a lot of it. Like almost all of the code was trashed and I put in new code, and I think it works a lot more efficiently now. We also, you know, we're working on porting it to all of these different consoles and such. The game, it's not a huge game, but like, it's complicated enough where like we wanted to hire out some outside help to help us. So we got Howling Moon Software to help us out, Andy and Scott.
Friends of the show.
Yeah.
They were wonderful in helping us port it and helping us get our network functionality, because now you can also play, cross-platform. You can play Xbox, Switch, PC against all of them.
That is, I think it's really valuable for a smaller release to get that audience. You've got three pools now for the three platforms, and it just works seamlessly between them, which is, I think a lot of people, gamers are coming to sort of expect that, but it's a lot of work.
Yeah, it is not easy.
Yeah.
Whole lot of stuff. But it's been very valuable. Treasure Stack is a very fun game. Definitely check it out. We have like trailers and such. We have a website.
Yeah.
We'll link to those.
It's got a great style and the mechanics are really fun, because it's like a bunch of dropping puzzle block games you've played, but it's it is unique, and you figure that out very quickly as you play, but it still maintains that approachability of a genre you're familiar with.
Yeah.
So it really works. It's the best of both of those worlds.
You got a really good tutorial. It took me forever to build, so you can take advantage of that too. please play it. Please let me know what you think of it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really interested. I'd like to hear it. Hear your thoughts.
A report from every one of you.
Treasure Stack is out March 1st. Xbox, Switch, and PC.
And now it's time for the audio spectacular.
What though? What are you doing here?
I thought it'd be a good example of audio tricks.
Yeah, you're not wrong. This is my topic, audio basics. So we came back from PodCon a couple weeks ago. We talked about that in a previous episode.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of talk about audio stuff. Mm-hmm. And amongst the three of us, I'm the one with the audio background. And you guys know a lot about it now,
mm-hmm.
Partly because you had to, but also because I probably don't shut up about it sometimes. but I thought I'd go over some of the basic stuff for audio. This would be useful if you want to start your own podcast. But of course, if you're a game developer and you're just throwing a bunch of MP3s into your build,
mm-hmm.
like this can give you some context of like, why doesn't this sounding right? Or you just a little bit of the, you know, it's not going to be a whole, you know, not even a full 101, but just some of the basic things you'll need to know to help you maybe avoid some of the early pitfalls as you start dealing with this kind of work. Because I know as designers, you guys both know, we've talked about on the show before, like the sound is really important to your game, not just the experience, the feel, but in fact, the proper design of it.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times you don't think about that until like us later. The earlier you think about it, the better off you'll be in all sorts of elements of your project.
Yes.
So, just a couple of basic things you probably are familiar with, like formats, WAVE, AIFF, if you're on Mac, those are uncompressed audio.
Okay.
They are just describing the waveform. We record Nice Games Club as uncompressed WAVE files. The file you get when you listen on your phone or your PC or wherever, that is an MP3. That's a heavily compressed file, in fact. That is not true for all types of workflows. Mm. If you're familiar with a lot of things, the more raw, uncompressed file, especially if you're a photographer and you have like raw image data, it can really, really pile up.
Oh.
Audio, it's not a solved problem, but it's just less. There's less of it.
Yeah.
Like, this is sort of simple stuff, but sometimes it's like, oh, okay, right? And not everybody knows this sort of thing.
I didn't know it.
Yeah. So, there's other audio, like really, there's just two audio formats as far as most people are concerned.
Yeah.
There's WAVE and there's MP3. WAVE is uncompressed. MP3 is heavily compressed. A little bit of background, MP3 was, I think the patent expired, but MP3 was designed by a German engineer and held by a German company,
mm-hmm.
and that patent needed to be licensed for playback and decoding. So if you had software that either encoded or decoded MP3, it needed to get a license to the MP3 spec. It's not open the way a lot of other specs are, but it's either nearly expired or expired now. But the thing about that patent is that it was never that difficult to get a license for it. So that's why most things could play back MP3s. Mm. It's also why some things couldn't. You know, that was more of an issue in the 90s when that was something where you had a lot more freeware trying to do that sort of thing. Or like MPEG as a video format.
Right.
Because that is held by a group that develops it, but also holds the patent and licenses those things. It's also the case for even things like HDR standards for video. So I'm not going to get into any of that. But basically, a lot of these formats, you know, somebody invents them. And so either they become open source by design or patents expire over time. You may have heard of the OGG audio format.
Yeah.
That's an open source audio format. And it's meant to get around a lot of these things. It's very common when you make mobile games, weirdly, to use OGG. Because, especially in web games as well, because you know that everything can decode it because of the licensing issue.
Sure, okay.
So there's the two things you got to deal with these formatting stuff. One is the actual technology, and the other is the sort of legal stuff.
Sure.
And I find this interesting, but I'm like a super nerd, so not everybody is interested in knowing about this stuff. But when you do know about it, it lets you at least understand the context of why things are and aren't possible.
That all makes a lot of sense, because I was like, with the WAVE stuff, the MP3 stuff, that made sense. But I was like, where does OGG fit into place? But all those licensings and things like that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, like WAVE, I believe Microsoft actually created it, but I don't think they've ever I think it's always been open. Okay. I don't think they've ever had a license for it. I think you should look up a lot of this stuff on your own, because I'm going from memory from a lot of these things. So just years and years of osmosis of these issues. And in fact, that's the working knowledge all you, you need. You don't actually need to know the full details on these all the time. But if you want to know specifics on these, I do advise you to look them up if you're actually curious. Or you're going to be making software that does encoding or decoding of these formats.
Yeah.
Okay, that was enough of a 101 on that.
Into the nitty-gritty.
So you'll see three numbers generally when you're encoding a piece of audio, mm-hmm. or if you're reading the metadata on a piece of audio. You'll see the bit depth, you'll see the bit rate, and you'll see the sample rate. Okay. And so I'll describe what each of those are, what the point of them is, and I'll talk a little bit about the file you're listening to now, this audio file. I can explain to you the properties of that, and so you can sort of maybe get some context as to what these things mean. So the first thing I'll tell you about is just the bit rate. So bit rate is the same as you'll see on in a video, which is how much data per second on a piece of temporal media, right?
Okay.
And so you'll see this file that you're listening to now is 96 kilobits per second. So that's how much data is being streamed if you're listening to it, say, in the web player. If you're listening to it on like on your phone, you download the whole file already probably. But that number is not used as a download number necessarily. It's not how fast it will download necessarily.
Okay.
It's how much data is being processed per second by the decoder, by the piece of software that's decoding the codec, right?
Okay.
So 96 kilobits per second is on the really low end when you're exporting files. This is also in stereo. You're hearing us in both channels equally. So it sounds a little bit like a mono. Like it's just coming out of one channel, but our theme song is in stereo. So the whole podcast is in stereo as a result. And I can get into channel stuff in a little bit. But that 96 kilobits per second, that amount of data, we sound okay, right? So even though it's pretty low, it sounds okay.
Yeah.
Now, if you were to have a recording of a really high-end orchestral recording, mm-hmm. like a movie soundtrack or something like that, 96 kilobits, maybe not going to cut it.
Yeah.
Depending on what kind of headphones you have, but you may be able to tell that it's not quite getting a lot of data. You get compression artifacts, very similar to video. And most people, I think, are familiar with video compression artifacts. The bit rate is too low. Not enough data is moving into your television or computer monitor fast enough. Then it needs the decoder needs to do more work to process the image. Mm-hmm. And it's not that the decoder is tripping over itself or anything. It's that there's just not enough data to complete a full picture. So when you see those compression artifacts, sometimes you rewind a little bit and watch it again, you'll see the exact same artifacts, right? It's a property of the file, not of the process to play it.
Ah.
And so compression artifacts in audio are much more rare. Mm-hmm. They're usually not as big of a problem. But if they are, they're so obvious that you want to get rid of them. So whereas video compression artifacts, it's amazing what people let Netflix get away with. Because I think Netflix video is 5 megabits per second, mm-hmm. I think is what most of their like HD video is. If you watch a Blu-ray disc on a Blu-ray player, that is, I believe, 35 or 40 megabits per second.
Wow.
Much, much higher.
Yeah.
And so Netflix also streams 4K. But like the actual quality of the video, like all the pixels are there.
Uh-huh.
But in terms of the data that is used to draw them on your television, it's a little substandard. So a lot of movie files will want, they still buy Blu-rays, for example.
For comparison's sake, Spotify has a high quality streaming.
Yep.
Do you know how fast the bitrate on that is?
I think it's probably 320 kilobits per second.
Okay.
Generally, that's what's seen as high end. So iTunes, for example, if you, I think all iTunes, like if you buy on iTunes and most like just purchase the song for 99 cents.
Yeah.
I think they're all 320 now.
Okay.
But it used to be that was the difference. It was like 192, I think, was common for a long time in the last decade.
Yeah.
And then 320 was seen as high. But I think that's probably what that is. Okay. I don't myself know.
Sure. But that sounds like maybe where the value could be.
Yeah. At 320 kilobits per second, your file's not going to be that big still. It's not going to be as big as a wave, uncompressed wave file. Mm-hmm. But you're going to get most of the quality in there. And now there's going to be audio files if we have any of our audience being like, well, you know, but, that's the face I make on a lot of other issues, but, but that's, it's high. That's pretty good.
Cool.
We're, less than a third of that
right.
for this podcast.
Yeah.
But we don't have a lot of demands on the quality of this audio.
Yeah.
And so that's perfectly fine. We also operate in a limited frequencies. Like, if there's certain things that we don't quite deliver at that quality, that's fine. And for the most part, I think that the theme for a lot of these numbers is that you would be surprised how low quality you could accept if a file is processed well enough.
Yeah.
Okay. So bit depth and sample rate. This is the resolution of the actual waveform itself.
Okay.
This is independent of the data rate. So data rate is about compressing the file, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Bit depth and sample rate are more about the capture of the file. So if you have like, if you think about video, or let's say like a point and shoot camera, right? Or a camera on your cell phone. You're like, oh, it's a 12 megapixel lens, or it's a 5 megapixel point and click or whatever, or it's a HD video camera. Mm-hmm. That tells you how much data is brought into the device. In audio, that you have bit depth and sample rate. Sample rate is kind of like frame rate, if you think about it in terms of video.
Okay.
So the sample rate of this file you're listening to is 44.1. It's many, many, many.
Yes.
And that is how many samples it takes of the piece of audio. So it says, at this sample, which is like a frame of video, what is the volume, the frequency? And then that's what a wave form is built out of, is those samples.
Right.
So analog audio is an infinite sample rate. Just like how analog film is infinite resolution, technically, right? There's no pixels on a strip of film. But the other qualities of a film lens or the quality of the film itself mean that the effective resolution is lower, right? So I'm getting into a side conversation, but it's going to make sense in a moment. A lot of people say things like, oh, film is so much better than digital video even today. But the truth is that the functional resolution, like the practical amount of like actual data on a piece of film is a little less than HD.
Oh.
Actually, it has different qualities. It looks a little different.
Sure.
But when you hear a lot of people, film purists talk about like, oh, it's so much this and that. It's like, not really true. Anyway, so sample rate is a little similar in that if you have a sample rate that is half as much as take a file and then re-encode it at half the sample rate. It's just a two-dimensional waveform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. You're going to think if you lose half the samples, how much data are you really losing if you just interpolate between those two?
Not a lot, especially if they're waves.
Right?
Yeah.
Like at a certain point, you can really drop it down a lot more. So generally when you're recording audio, so as we do here for the podcast, there's two very common sample rates, 48,000 and then 44,100, right? It was just 48 and 44.1.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the very common ones. CD audio is 44.1. And I think that number was actually chosen for the CD spec. I might be wrong on that. Because it allowed them to get exactly the right amount of time on a disc as they needed. Because each sample is a piece of data, right? And so the denser, the more samples you take, the bigger the file.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, then you apply a bitrate compression to it, and then you can feed it anything, and it will spit out at that rate, right? So that's, again, there's different things. Bit depth is similar, but on the other dimension. So I won't get too much deep into that, but basically those two details are what determine the resolution of your waveform. Now, a lot of audiophiles will want really high-end 96 kilohertz sample rates, 32-bit floating point bit depth, really, really high values for these things when you're recording. Or when you take a recording and then you encode it at those high rates, the truth is all the audio you listen to is analog. It's coming out of speakers going into your ears.
Yeah.
So there is no, unlike if, you know, this is true also of the things you see with your eyes, right? It's analog, but you can see the pixels on a television, right?
Yeah.
You can't actually pick out each sample. And so even if you are having at a high sample rate or even a much lower sample rate, that waveform is still being given to you by the vibration of your speaker.
Yeah.
So if you actually are, it is already doing the interpolation.
Yeah.
So even a 96 kilohertz, 98 kilohertz sample rate file is going to vibrate using essentially the same waveform, just with a little bit more detail in between each of those samples. Like high fidelity audio is very much overhyped. Because
are you saying that all of those expensive headphones I bought?
No, actually, the difference there is that like a high-end speaker equipment, right, or headphones,
yeah,
is it had the drivers that move the speakers, The frequency response of the digital to analog converter that's in the headphones.
Yeah.
That is totally irrespective of this.
Sure.
Right? It's about the audio you feed it.
Oh, right? Okay.
So they've done little like blind tests where they bring in an audio file and they have a nice speaker system and then they will play like a file and then the same file at a lower or higher sample rate and we'll test to see. And generally you cannot tell the difference, even if you have a really well-tuned ear.
Sure.
Because it works differently, right? But we very much are trained to like think better numbers are better or higher numbers are better.
Yeah.
And that's true in a lot of cases. There's certainly sample rates, the more complex a piece of audio is. And this is true especially with things like when you're doing forensic analysis on audio, higher sample rates is more data.
Sure.
Right. Yeah. And so there's no reason to say no to that.
Yeah.
But in terms of like music, stuff you're doing for your game, you don't need to worry about setting those settings too high.
Okay.
Even 16-bit bit depth is fine.
Okay.
Also, it's not really going to lower the size of your file that much, ultimately. And if you are compressing to MP3, then it's going to be at the bit rate you decide. And then the encoder is going to take what you give it. And so if you give it something with a really high sample rate, and you have a low bit rate, but the sample rate stays high, you're kind of wasting a lot of your data, right? Your data budget, right?
Yeah.
So that's just some advice for when you set those values. You can really Google a lot of this and get something similar. So now that I've given you some context, you can decide where you want to, how you want to pull those levers if you're making certain choices with your audio. All right, so channels, pretty simple. Audio works in on different channels, which is just different tracks of audio. Mono is just one channel. Stereo is two.
Right.
If you've heard 5.1, that doesn't make any sense. Like, what's a 0.1 channel?
The 0.1 is the subwoofer.
That's right. And the subwoofer is actually another channel. So it's six channels.
Yeah.
It's just called that because it's different.
Yeah.
The point is not a decimal place. It's not a dot in a versioning system. It's just a silly naming convention. So you'll often see 2.1. You'll see a 2.1 desktop speaker set. That's just two speakers and a subwoofer.
Right.
And a subwoofer, purpose of a subwoofer is to basically just send out the signals at the low end that the speakers are unable to handle. So there's two ways to do that. If you have a piece of stereo audio that's just two channels, left and right, just two pieces of audio that go together, and you put that through a 2.1 audio system, well, the one isn't going to get anything, right? It's not, there's no track you feed it. So what'll happen, either the speaker will do this or the sound card will do this, somewhere along the way, it will isolate the frequencies from the two channels that the subwoofer wants to handle and just feed it the both channels of those frequencies. Now, if you're listening to a surround sound, like a movie, either in a theater or your home theater system, a lot of times that subwoofer channel will be its own piece of audio track, but not always.
Okay.
Right? It sort of depends. There's actually quite a bit of different ways to organize these. If you're building surround sound for your video game, for example, a lot of times it's just about spatial audio.
Sure,
so you don't need to necessarily manually mix a lot of things. You'll have mono sources as sound clips in your world space. And then you'll have an audio listener that then processes those signals and sends a mix of all those things to the different channels.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times your audio middleware will handle a lot of this. But sometimes if you're designing, especially when you're doing film or music that's surround sound, you have to be much more hands-on with where you put channels and stuff like that.
That makes sense.
And so there's a bunch of general conventions about this sort of thing. You want, like if you're doing music, for example, generally you want the lead vocalist to be in the center channel. So if you're in a surround sound system, there is a center channel.
Mm.
But if it's stereo, you just put them equally in both.
Yeah.
And then that feels like it sounds like in the middle.
Yeah.
And so even with just two channels, you can get a much really interesting sort of space for how you do it. Also, like you have drums generally get split, sort of spread across it. So it sort of feels like it's around you.
Yeah.
Now, the reason I mention this is because the conventions on these have changed over the years. So if you listen to a bunch of old Beatles records, this is my favorite thing. You'll hear the entire drum set in the left channel.
Yeah. That's something that happens in jazz tracks too.
Uh-huh.
Like you'll oftentimes hear just the saxophone on your right and then, drums on the left or something like that.
Yeah. Because a lot of times when multi-channel delivery was an option, like think about if you're sitting in orchestra hall or like you're watching a big band jazz troupe, they're all in front of you,
right?
So like the idea of stereo being something that was about like a sound field is actually unique to recorded music in an interesting way.
And so
it feels like, oh, of course you put the snare drum on the left and the low tom on the right because that's how it is on the thing, and it has this full sound. It's like that wasn't an obvious thing.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the early stereo recordings in the 50s and 60s just sort of like came up with their own standards for this. And what's interesting is it's kind of dogma now. So if you're like a rock band, there's like a way to mix, right?
Yeah.
And so I guess this is just me saying, like, think about that. And if you, you know, if you are doing especially musical compositions for your video games, if you want to get a sense of unease, or you want to guide a listener or confuse them in a certain way, you can take those conventions, those sort of like cultural like expectations, and you can do some tweaks there, right? You can put your lead melody instrument, you could double track it and put it on both channels so that they're slightly different, so they don't sound like they're in the middle.
Yeah.
That's a way to make an open space. It's also a way to make the melody not feel forward facing. There's like a ton. It's an amazing art form just to do a stereo field.
That's cool.
And that's just with two channels. With surround sound, you get the tools you have at your disposal are even larger. Mm-hmm. Of course, a lot of times game audio is going to be processed by an audio listener in a scene or something like that. And so that's a whole other issue there.
Yeah. Is there such a thing as like 5.2
subwoofers?
I do know that like the reason a subwoofer is not split into different channels is because low frequencies, the human ear has a hard time discerning their location.
Sure.
And so there's not much benefit to having a left subwoofer and a right subwoofer.
Yeah.
That said, I'm sure it's been tried.
I want to look into this.
What do we got next on this list? Okay, so now we can talk a little bit about how to process audio.
Yeah.
So a lot of times you'll hear this, especially in like Game Jam games will do. You'll get like just audio clips from freesound.org, which is, I super recommend it.
Yep.
People just put up their audio. It's all Creative Commons. So make sure you credit those users if you use their audio, but it's all free. And a lot of it's pretty good. People just record it, or it's like the quality is absolutely varying, but it's a great resource for filmmakers, for even musicians who are doing sound effects in their work, and especially for game designers. But a lot of those clips, you can't just grab them and put them in your game. You got to do something to them. You got to make them fit in your world.
Right.
And so there's two main things when you process audio. One is dynamics processing, which is about the volume, about loudness.
Okay.
And the other one is equalization, which is about isolating frequencies.
Sure.
So I'll do them one at a time. Dynamics processing is basically the idea of just saying the input of audio is a one dimension of loudness. The output is another dimension of loudness. Mm-hmm. So you can think of a 2D chart, and you can think of a graph that's like a curve, which shows like, oh, as a piece of audio gets louder and louder and louder on the input, as you feed it in, it gets louder and louder on the output as well.
Yeah.
But the curve is, if it's just one-to-one, it's just a diagonal line.
Right.
But as you adjust the curve, you can change how it works. So you can say at the upper end of volume, once it gets past a certain volume, I don't want it to actually get louder. So I will then make all the volumes higher than that, just the same as this, you know, middle level. That's called a compressor. It takes the loudest parts and brings them down to the middle. Now, I say loudest, but what I really mean is highest volume. Mm-hmm. Loudness is a subjective feeling. So this is a very, again, using popular music as an example, because it always has good ones for these, is a lot of older music, jazz music in particular, has really wide dynamic range. If you listen on headphones, it feels like a huge space.
Mm-hmm.
You hear a little tickety-tack of the brushes on a snare.
Yeah.
And then you hear the big boom of the low toms.
Yeah, it's great.
Right? And like, you know, you have horns that roll up, and they have these like high, really wide range of volumes.
Yeah.
Now, listening to that in headphones sounds great, right?
Mm-hmm.
But let's say you're listening to it in your car with the windows down.
Ah.
You're not really going to hear most of it.
No.
You're just going to hear the biggest bangs, right?
Yep.
And it's not going to sound good. Mm-hmm. And so what you can do is if you take a piece of audio like that and heavily compress it so that the range of quietest to loudest is very narrow, you can play it anywhere and you can hear all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're still going to know which parts are louder than other parts, because loudness is largely subjective.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, volume, it plays a part in how loud it feels.
Yeah.
But you could very frequently, like, again, blind listening, you can say which one is louder. And very most of the time, people get them wrong.
Mm.
It's really easy to fool people in that sense.
Okay.
Just like how when you go outside and your eyes adjust to the light.
Yeah.
And you go inside and your eyes adjust to that light.
Mm.
So loudness works the same way in terms of how you can, like, so your brain really just does a lot of that dynamic compression live in your own head. And so you can trick someone to thinking something feels really loud without the volume being very high. So compression is great for that. Now, of course, the downside, and a lot of people have noted this, is that you get less dynamic range means less data. It's less information about the track.
Right.
It makes a thing feel smaller in a lot of ways. And so the best audio engineers for music really have to walk that line. And you can actually see, partly because the technology is a lot better, so it's easier to do, but also because tastes have moved towards making sure all pop songs sound great on all speakers in all situations.
Yeah.
That you can see some comparisons from old pop music and new pop music and just how different they are, how the waveforms look really different. Mm-hmm. But also, that has also changed people's musical tastes, right?
Sure, yeah.
Because those heavily compressed pop songs tend to then be what is promoted more and what sells more, was more popular. And so it becomes what you listen for as the sign of a highly produced, good quality piece of music.
Yeah.
And so it becomes very interesting to go against that grain. And this is true of a lot of areas of art, of course. Anyways, for you and your game, dynamic processing is really important because you want to make sure that if you have a sound effect that's in the world, a lot of times you're going to, the volume is going to be adjusted based on your audio listener. If it's a 3D game, even a 2D game, like Widget Satchel works this way.
Right. Yeah.
Whereas you get closer to enemies, their little looping sound gets closer to you as well, in the stereo field. If you're working with a system like that, you want to make sure that it feels right. And so a lot of times you'll have audio clips that you'll throw in there that will feel too loud, but you look at them on a waveform, you're like, they're exactly as loud as the other thing. And so you have to make those kinds of adjustments. So I'm not going to be able to do a little masterclass here, but it's something you should be definitely investigating. It's why a lot of things don't feel the loudness that they should, because they were the rooms they were recorded in, sometimes it's artificially generated audio. And so you can use a simple dynamics processor to make those adjustments if you need to. It's also a really good way. We use it on the show here. So when you listen to us, like I'm whispering right now, it makes me feel relatively quiet, or I'm talking very loud now, we're looking at the waveform as I record this and they're quite a bit different. Mm-hmm. But you, if you were to take the file you get when you, you know, on your phone, put it into something to view it, they'd be much, much closer because we do dynamics processing here because we want to make sure you can listen to this in your car with the windows down.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Also, isn't it to kind of balance out the three of us because we each have different volumes of talking?
That is definitely true. And we do that for that reason. But if we had a separate producer here with us, like a fourth person who handled the board, that would be their job.
Ah.
So we offload that a little bit to the post-processing. But yeah, absolutely. That's why you do that. And that's definitely true of balancing things in your game as well.
Yes.
You have things that are actually louder, but you want the player to hear them at the same volume as something that is quieter. But you want to give them the impression that one is louder than the other. And so a lot of times you'll see people who are just throwing their sounds into their game like, well, this is a really quiet thing, so I'm going to make it really quiet. Like, that's actually not a good user experience, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of times you'll think about all the RPGs you play that have little like audio clips that are like clues. They cue you into a thing. If you were to hear those sounds at that volume in the real world, it would be like, it would seem ridiculously loud.
Yeah.
In terms of what it's doing, but it's meant as a piece of user interface.
Right.
And so that's another thing you have to think about when you think about these things is like, how does it fit in the world? Not even if you're making a fully realistic world, you have to decide like how, you know, what's the abstraction layer you do for your players.
Yeah.
And so audio
that's
plays
very
a big
good.
Part now.
I think that like, I don't know if you've ever, you should try playing your games or just games in general without music and just like see, hear all of the sounds that they have.
Yeah.
Like there's a whole lot of different sounds that people put in the stuff to make things feel more or less important. Mm-hmm. That like that user interface kind of stuff that Mark is talking about. I think that's really important for people. I've been playing Skyrim for a long time now, and I actually play the game without any music. I just play it with just sounds.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so you can hear all of that stuff. So I like, you know, I've modded the game to the point where like the sounds are important.
Yeah.
Much better now.
This is testing we have yet to do in Widget Satchel, which is to test music only, sound effects only. Mm. We've had various states of the build, which only had one or the other.
Yeah.
And we have a sort of rough idea, but we haven't done enough testing with that yet.
Right.
And it'll be interesting to see. I'm really curious to see if a sound effects only actually sounds interesting or annoying, you know? But one of the things we did in testing was we were testing a level, all of our enemies in the game, they have like a little like sort of loop, little chattering kind of.
Right.
And as you get closer to them, the audio gets a little louder and because our main character is the audio listener in the game.
Yeah.
So that's really nice because you know when an enemy's coming up, you know as you're leaving, it's a cute sort of like nice little sound. Mm-hmm. But there was a bug we had where all that wasn't working. Oh. But we didn't really care because we were developing the game in that it was over the summer. We had the audio turned off when we were testing. So we weren't working on it. We knew it was there. We just wasn't a big deal. Mm-hmm. But we did a play test. And I remember somebody being really surprised by all the robots coming out of the side of the wall. And if I was like, oh man, we might need to redesign that thing to make it move the camera out a little bit or maybe put a place where the player has to jump over something so they don't just run into the bot that's on the way. Mm-hmm. And then it hit us. Oh, right. In the game, you get different cues that a robot is getting close to you.
Yeah.
And we hadn't really considered that, at least for that part of it. And so a lot of times you design your game visually first and then with the audio second.
Right.
But, and that's, you know, there's a practicality to that. It's hard to do this all at once.
Yeah.
But make sure you bounce back and forth in your design process. Mm-hmm. So you don't leave out opportunities to, you know, you don't over design an element that audio can play a role in.
Yeah. Humans are also, they're more able to react to audio than they are to visuals, mm-hmm. visual cues. So the audio is more important for people, especially like if you have a very high reaction sort of thing going on in your game. It's very important to like for that to be good and important.
Right. So like a precision platformer, you might not think of this, but you would probably want a sound effect for both the jump and the land.
Yeah.
And even though that's ridiculous, no one makes a sound when they jump. Uh-huh. That is about the UX of it, and about especially when you're thinking, oh, I like, did the button not work? I feel like I jumped earlier than that. The audio gives you an even better clue as to the moment in time that you registered an input.
Right.
And it helps the player feel more immersed in the world, more connected physically to the game.
Yeah.
Because audio people react a little stronger to that than visual cues.
Totally.
Which you do so much interpolation in when you look at stuff much more than you do for audio. Mm-hmm. Just to keep you going, like, you know, just think about all the times you blink. And I hate doing this because every time someone talks about blinking, then suddenly you're distracted by that. So I apologize to listeners. But think about how much you don't see. Your brain just fills in those moments.
Yeah.
And how much of that is. There's a spot in the dead center of your eye where no light gets to, because it's where your the nerve cluster is. Mm-hmm. And so you actually have literally a blind spot in the dead center of both of your eyes. I challenge you to find it. Like, your brain just fills it in.
Mm-hmm.
Even though there's literally nothing there.
Yeah, brains are
powerful. It's kind of amazing. So audio really helps you get a fuller picture. It's not extra. It's not something separate. It should really be something you put in together with it.
Totally.
So we went really off the rails there, but the other thing I want to talk about actually processing is equalization.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really just about different frequencies of audio. So I think a lot of people know the basics of this: low frequencies, low rumbled; high frequencies, higher chirps, you know, that kind of thing. And we talked a little bit about how speakers can handle that sort of differently. But you should know that, like, a quick little piece of trivia: the human speech lives between 85 and 255 hertz, and that's the peaks and valleys of the waves that they operate at. But that's the range where when we do here on the show, we do a little bit of equalization where those really low frequencies where none of us speak at, and the really, really high frequencies that none of us can even hear, we roll those off. But with EQ, it's basically about changing the volumes of different batches of frequencies.
Okay.
So you can also compress audio at different frequencies. So if you are compressing the whole bit of audio, the dynamics processor, that simple two-dimensional graph, you can do that for a certain range of frequencies different from a certain other range of frequencies. And this is where you get into really, really intense audio mastering. And so it's generally out of the scope of most people. It's also sometimes you don't really have to do it in a lot of places. But if you care about this stuff and you really want a certain thing to work a certain way and it's not in your game, you have to think about, like, well, is it not just the dynamics processing, but is it also the frequency at which this audio operates at? So if you have a piece of music in your game, let's say you're making some Uncharted clone or something, and you have like a fight on a train. Well, in the ambient sound effects, you have lots of rumbling of the tracks and the wheels and the rails.
Right.
And in the music, is probably going to have lots of high strings or something, right? And maybe you have enemies who are chattering in the background so you can see them coming. That's going to be at human frequencies. And so what's left for other sound effects, right? Mm-hmm. You have to find a space in that field to put things so that they sound right. If you have something like, oh, let's say there's a certain section, I'm just making this up on the fly, and a barrel, like an explosive barrel, rolls towards you, and you need to know that's coming so you can get out of the way before it blows up.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to make a really low rumbling sound, but you're already on this train and it's making a bunch of low rumbling sounds. So do you need to maybe artificially change the way that sounds? Maybe you change the design. Maybe you have it have things like bells dangling on the corner of it so it makes a higher pitched noise that comes to you. Like, all of that design becomes part of like building a world so that the player can interact with it in a way that, so the user experience kind of works in the way you want it to,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
If you want it to be something that they don't notice, then maybe that's the story reason why they don't notice it, is because it doesn't sound different. Like, it's too loud, they can't hear it,
mm-hmm.
right? And you can use all of that, but it really depends on what your intention is for those moments. And if it's not working for what you've done, you need to change either the world around it where it's happening or the thing that's happening in it. You kind of can't just be like, well, it doesn't really work exactly, but fine. I wanted it to do this and I want the world to be that. So, okay.
Yeah.
Like, that's not good enough. You have to make those things work together.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of that's about frequency, about like where it lives in the spectrum of your hearing range. And, so yeah, I had the range for what humans sound, where they speak, But also you can find out what the actual range of people's hearing generally is.
Yeah.
It's much narrower, just like the visual spectrum. It's much narrower than you are capable of producing. Mm-hmm. So you can have ultra low frequencies, and you can have them wiggle at the end of the range if you want to. Horror games are great at this. They have ambient tracks that are really, really low. And so you almost don't know you're hearing anything.
Yeah.
You know? You can also have higher pitch things to like annoy all the dogs of your users. That's totally up to you. But all of this is just a wonderland of design choices you can make. And that's of course designing sounds for that, but also taking existing sounds and modifying the equalization properties to nudge them where you need them to be.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's, yeah, it's these are all design decisions as well as technical decisions.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's cool.
Mm-hmm. Just sort of like do's and don'ts. You should definitely be play testing with and without audio.
Yeah.
People are going to play your game without audio.
Yes.
So think about that as well.
Yeah.
Ideally, I think it's okay to say that you don't need to make them equal experiences necessarily. There's an accessibility issue, of course. Right. If you have deaf players, you want to make sure that there's anything that's mission critical that you have to seriously consider like how important that is, which right. isn't to say you should not do any kind of game design that is audio dependent, but you need to know that's what you're doing.
Right.
So that if you are offering that lesser experience to people who have that disability, you need to be comfortable with that. Like you need to sort of like own it and decide. And you need to be able to, if possible, offer alternatives that give enough of a similar experience. Sometimes that's just with subtitles for voice, mm-hmm. but that's not the end of the game, right? There's more to it than that.
Yeah.
If you have a lot of audio cues and designs in your game, you should think about how that affects people who either are hard of hearing, are non-hearing, or just prefer to have the audio off, right?
Mm-hmm.
So these are all decisions you have to sort of weigh and balance as you work. Yeah. So, I mean, there's like tons of examples we can go on forever, but I think that kind of covers
it. Yeah. I mean, that was a good jump into it. I think that the audio doesn't get a lot of credit. Like a lot of this kind of stuff doesn't get enough credit in games. Mm-hmm. And like it's important.
Yeah.
People need to know about it. And like, especially if you're an indie game developer, this is, you're probably one of the only people working on your game. So you are probably going to be the one doing this.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's helpful to have that.
That's a good point. Cause there's an issue of scope, right?
Yeah.
Like if you hear some of this and if it inspires you to like try a million things, keep in scope.
That's a good point. Yes.
Right. That's true of all these things. Is like it is important to know all this stuff, but you don't always have to use every piece of it.
Right.
You know, save some of it for the next game. Martha, don't you have a transition for us?
Just trying to think of a good one.
And now it's time for representation games.
Martha, don't steal the spotlight from Martha.
We both need to be represented.
Hey.
There.
That's great. Yes, so my topic is representation in games. Because I think it's important.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people think it's important.
Yeah.
It's important stuff.
Prove it.
I'll try. So what is representation? It's basically just including people of all different genders, ethnicities, ages, body types, sexual orientations, etc. in both the development process of your game and the games themselves. And there's a lot of benefits to this, not just because like people can see themselves in the game and that feels good. But also like, especially if you like include people who are, everybody is unique and different. And like, as we said before, when you're making a game you make is going to be vastly different from another person's game. And so as a result, the more people you include in your development process, the more unique your game will end up being. So like that's very valuable on its own. As a development head, like the more pools of people you look at, the more potential hires you get and the more likely you'll get somebody who's perfect for the role that you're looking for. So that's valuable. And more people will look at your game because like it looks different from all the other games out there, which is great. It just makes games good. Did I prove it?
You could have just ended with that. Started with that piece. Like,
yeah,
makes games good.
Makes games good, y'all.
I think it is sometimes important to ask because I think people are generally in agreement that it's good.
Yeah.
They don't always know why. And sometimes they're like fine not knowing why. They just feel like it's something you should do.
Yeah.
But it's important to explain that it does make games good.
Right. And frankly, representation is important in different ways for different people too. Because like maybe you might just, you might be just looking for like a unique kind of game, something that like you haven't seen before. And like, if you go to a team, if you go to the same Ubisoft team, you're going to keep getting Far Cry or whatever it is. but like, if you go somewhere else, somewhere that like a lot of people, or there aren't as many games being made in that area, then you'll get a more unique game, like not just narratively, but also like gameplay wise, mechanically, they'll be different.
Yeah.
Because they have different influences. And so like, it'll bring you a unique experience that you may not have had before. That is very valuable.
Yeah. I think people understand the idea of like variety in games. And this is just a dimension of that.
Yeah.
That is, you can't just decide on your own to have that dimension. You actually have to work to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, everybody is different. So like the game I make is just, it's going to be different. It's going to be completely different because I just have a different background set. So like everybody has something to bring to the table.
Mm-hmm.
That's my main point. So yeah, I wanted to talk about like, what are good ways of being inclusive? What ways you can try to invite more people into the space of both making games and into the space of your game specifically.
Mm-hmm.
I think the best thing to do is just to include more people from the beginning, who are include more of that representation in your development process.
Do you mean just generally, or you mean like that aligns with what your game is also representing?
Well, in generally too, because like it'll bring more fresh ideas into the space. But also, like just like specifically, if you're trying to talk about a group of people's experiences, it's helpful to have them be a part of the process right away in the beginning.
Sure,
you know, you get all the historical context and stuff right away, or potentially a lot of the historical context.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, that's great and all, but like maybe you don't have access to that, like because you know you have to pay them and stuff. And you know, paying people costs money.
Paying them. That's the worst. what if you are working alone?
Well, sometimes it's not a feasible option. Yeah. Or you want to work on the game alone or something like that. There are other options too. There are diversity consultants you can, ask for help with.
Mm-hmm.
You can do a lot of research. You can go and ask people, ask people, you know, like, can you help me with this thing? And they'll be like, yeah, sure. You know, just make sure to give them money though for doing that. Paying people.
Yep. Right. At a certain point, like this is, you can ask for favors, but this is a pretty big favor when you're asking someone to represent something for you. It can be awkward.
And also that person has different experiences from other people in their group.
Yes.
I'm not a representative of all Black people, for example.
We are not a monolith.
Right. Oh man, there's that Key and Peele sketch with the Black Republicans that you're referencing. Oh, I love that sketch. The best. And so they have their own experiences, and so like that person is not a representative of their entire culture.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to take note of that and, you know, ask different opinions of other people too.
There was in my high school theater class, there was one African-American girl, and it was so frustrating because the teacher constantly, he would ask her like, so from the African-American perspective, what do you think? And she was like, screw you.
Yeah. That kind of stuff. That, don't do that. I think it's also important to, you know, talk about stories that are outside of your comfort zone. Like, for example, maybe I could make a game about Arizona climate instead of Minnesota climate.
Are you crazy? We don't know anything about the sun.
What is...
It burns!
but like, you know, if you jump out of your comfort zone, like you can, learn about a new thing, which is cool. Always great. But also just, you know, like that's part of how we're making games. It's like you had to get out of our comfort zone to start coding the thing or start figuring out how audio works or start drawing. So like you could do that with your narratives or the what you're trying to do with your game.
You know, Stephen, you're hitting on kind of a difficult question, which is, there's two schools of thought kind of about this, which is the write what you know and stay in your lane kind of idea.
Yeah.
Right. Like don't, because the risk of appropriation is fairly large.
Yeah.
But also what you were saying is really convincing, which is to say like, yeah, go ahead and write something you don't know, but go ahead and try to know it.
Yes. Along the way. Well, yeah, I want to bring that up because like, I think that particularly now where we got Twitter and people will call you out if you do anything bad, can be scary.
Yeah.
And I mean, rightfully so, because you don't want to be called out on Twitter. They know where you tweet. I don't know. But I think it's also important, and we should encourage this for people to try to talk about. They should be encouraged to tell stories that like they may not have experienced,
mm-hmm.
because I think that it's important that like some people just like are not, some people are just not able to make games. Some people like they just don't have access to it, or like they, or it's difficult for them, or they just don't have the time, or a whole bunch of other things, but they can still assist with the development process.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, like you can share a story that is unique, that is different, that is important, that would not be told otherwise if you just like go out there and try. Like Never Alone, for example. We bring that game up. I think we brought it up a bunch. But that game was made with the tribe that they're talking about in mind, and like they literally like they had them involved in the development process of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And that like made that game all the much better because of it.
Mm-hmm.
So like that kind of stuff is important.
What do you say to someone who says like, "Don't tell a story that's not yours"?
I totally see that point.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, like a lot of times I'm like, you probably shouldn't do that. It's like, it's a weird conflict, because I want more stories told, but yeah. I also want more people to tell those stories. So,
it feels like the solution to that as a cultural problem is to get more diverse people making games.
That is my ideal.
But that doesn't help you if you're making a game right now or even in the future where there are more people making games.
Yeah.
But a lot of times you hear that, like, don't tell a story that's not yours.
Yeah,
it's a risk, right?
Yeah, and I think it's important to involve people who are a part of that story, but like it's sometimes that's not possible. Sometimes like you just can't do it, but then you need to make sure that you do the research to do that story correctly.
Yeah.
And I think that like that's important for people. And it like this is in any games, like, you know, we only have so many resources, we only have so many budget, you can't fly all over the world to talk to all these people to get this to work. But this is much worse in like AAA games, where they have those resources and they have like the time and stuff to do that kind of stuff, and they will get it wrong. But it's also not, I mean, it's also okay sometimes to get things wrong.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're going to get things wrong. I'm going to get things wrong. You're going to get things wrong. Mm-hmm. We're humans. We're not perfect.
Yeah. And if you face consequences, then that's the way it is. But mm-hmm. it shouldn't scare you completely.
Yeah. You learn from it.
Yeah.
Yeah. The important thing is you learn from it. If you make a mistake, own up to it.
Mm-hmm.
Acknowledge that you made a mistake and you're going to do better in the future.
Yeah.
That's the important thing. Mm-hmm. That's what you should.
Yeah.
Hold on to.
Martha, is this all track for you? You have any unique perspective on it?
Yeah. I think that makes sense. I was just thinking of this, like sometimes when you end up doing the research, you realize that you shouldn't be the one telling the story. Yeah. The Donut County guy, I think I've told that story on the podcast before, but his original game was going to be about the Hopi tribe. Mm-hmm. And he like was doing all the right things, like going and talking to the actual like tribal members and like doing all this research. And they're like, why are you making this game about us? And he was like, well, because I thought it'd be cool. And like, they're like, okay, I don't know if this like was really. Yeah. And he was like, yeah, that's kind of a good point. I don't really know why I'm making it about, like, I just chose it as a thing.
Right. Yeah.
And so then he made it about his experience. So. Like his hometown.
The impression I got is that the Hopi tribe did not want that story told that he was trying to tell.
Yes.
And he respected that, and he was like, "Oh no, I'm just going to change this game to something that makes more sense for me."
Yeah.
So
then the question is like, if I'm making something and I want to either honor something that it's a very interesting topic of mine, that I really like, or something I really want to a story told that no one's told or whatever, but isn't mine exactly.
Yeah.
How do I know that I'm the one to tell it? Well, the answer is. Do the research and ask the people.
Right.
Right. Like you will find out if you can tell it, I guess. You can't just do it theoretically.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. 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 Exactly. Yeah. You can't just, if you just do it and don't figure out why you're doing it, it'll end up being a
bad representation of things.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you do your research and you, you know, cross your T's, dot your I's, or whatever
that
phrase is, you'll have a much better understanding of how to approach it and such.
Well, here's a question.
Yes.
Is bad or let's say imperfect representation better than no representation?
Oh boy. I don't have a cool answer for you on that, because that's hard.
I feel like a really good example of that is like the strong female protagonist trope.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Which is a sort of a bad and male gazy view of what women are. But is that better than no female character's representation?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, if it's, yes, it's better because in one way, because at least you're getting to play a female character.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that should not be misinterpreted as an endorsement.
No.
Right.
Like if you, I don't know.
Well,
it's hard to know. It really depends, I guess, which is not a great podcast answer, but you know.
Well, part of this is like, there's not full answers to this. We're just three people here working games in Minnesota. We can't answer all the questions.
Yeah.
But like we're trying.
So just short answer, do not listen to us. I mean, listen to us. We need those stats, people, but
right. I feel like if it's a poor representation to the point where like you may not have, I'm concerned about a character where like their background like is like washed away and is not important to like the actual impact that the character makes in their narrative.
Yeah.
In which case, then it doesn't feel like it's not really a representation. It's just a character you made. And I think that like that is a factor in that. So like with the strong female protagonist thing, if like it doesn't matter whether or not they're male or female or what, then is that even really representation at that point? Is my question.
Right. Right. That's interesting.
Well, I mean, in one way, I guess I feel like that might be, even from my perspective, like better, because then it's not like we made this character a girl because she had to be a girl. Because there's a girl can't be in a woman can't be in a game unless it's about her being a woman.
Sure.
Right. It promotes the idea of the default.
Yeah.
Which is that might be the most insidious idea.
Mm.
So in that way, but on the other hand, like, yeah, but like if you're making a platformer game where the character doesn't really matter, then I'm like, yeah, you should be able to pick whether you're, you know, what gender you are and what race you are and stuff. But if it's, a narrative story and like you would want to have like a realistic background and things that they have had to deal with, I guess.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe. You don't want to do the thing that you, when you're hiring staff or you're working with people.
Yeah.
It's the same issue. It's to say like, you can't ask someone of a diverse group to represent that diverse group.
Yes.
Right. And so that's sort of true with characters too. I think if you write a character who for plot or specific character reasons or background reasons, it needs to intersect with that culture or that representation, that's fine.
Yeah.
But you shouldn't feel like that's the only reason to make a character like that. Right? One of the things in Widget Satchel, our human crew is mostly women because I was drawing a bunch of character ideas and after four, I'm like, that's fine. Like, that was, that's enough. And it's like, oh, well, there's only one dude and he's like a sort of a dorky looking bald guy. Right. I don't think there was a statement behind that other than like, I didn't want to draw any more humans. But at the same time, like, I could totally see someone saying like, oh, they just did that to like, you know, for quota reasons or something.
Pandering.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, it's almost like no way to win exactly. But as long as you're true to your own intentions, maybe.
Sometimes it does feel like pandering even when it's not.
Right.
I mean, not to say that like we did that in Widget Satchel or anything like that, but sometimes it feels like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's Black History Month right now and we're getting a whole bunch of commercials about...
Oh my God.
Black History Month, y'all. So buy our things. Yeah.
Black people using laundry detergent. And
Oh man, those McDonald's commercials when they have like, you can tell. There's the music and like the announcing, the people who are talking and like, that's a whole.
Oh man.
That's a separate.
Well, here's a question. Like, I mean, is that pandering worse than no representation? again, not seeking to endorse that.
Oh, yeah.
But totally. Like, you know, I mean, even people's clumsy efforts are though, is that good, or should that be discouraged?
The problem is they're only doing it for the month that it's Black History Month and they want to get the numbers.
Oh, yeah. It is absolutely pandering.
Yeah. They would never have hired those people in general, mm-hmm. because they would have overlooked them for the regular commercials.
And also, to be fair to McDonald's, they play those kinds of commercials throughout the year. It still feels like pandering, but at least it's not just on February.
Right.
so there's that.
Yeah.
I think the purpose and why you're making the product matters. I think that there was that toxic masculinity campaign thing that was, I don't remember. Was it a Dove thing?
Some
soap or something.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Some like a product. Lotion or, oh, it was a razor company.
Yeah. But
this is how effective this ad was.
I'm sure it was great.
Yeah.
That came out and they were like specifically saying they were speaking out against toxic masculinity, but they were also, you know, advertising their product in the process of
it.
And it's like, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? I kind of felt like it was a good thing because, like, at the end of the day, the message is still getting out there.
Yep.
And, like, the way that the advertisement worked, it wasn't like all these people, like, promoting the product and also, you know, toxic masculinity is bad. It was, like, mainly focused on that issue.
Yeah.
So, like, I felt like it was cool the way that they did it.
Yeah, I think people get really cynical about advertisers when they lean into social issues.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to realize that an ad's main job is to get you to buy their thing.
Yeah.
So like it when someone says like, oh, they were just doing that so you'd buy your thing, it's like, well, yeah,
that's what ads for.
It's like it's like it, as long as the message is not either cynical or
promoting a stereotype,
yeah, right. or does more harm than good,
yeah,
like I do not mind an ad agency being like, let's hitch onto this social thing so we can catch that wave. It's like, great,
because then also
it's a force multiplier,
more people see it.
Yeah
And like the big companies have more money than us, so they can get more people to see it.
Yeah. And if they're motivated by, you know, dollar bills, like, whatever.
Our whole culture is motivated by dollar bills.
Right, that's how things work.
Yep.
It's all good.
To that point, I think that, like, my view on that sort of pandering or tokenism is I think there's very frequent potential for that to do more harm than good. Because I think a lot of people think it lets them off the hook.
Yeah.
And it stops the conversation.
Yeah.
And I think that's the biggest danger. Even if it may, say, increase the net amount of quote unquote representation in a certain field, a certain area, I think there are knock-on effects that can blunt its progress going forward. I think this is impossible to measure and certainly very unfair to level it, you know, example by example. Yeah. But I worry about that a lot, that people are like, oh, well, I checked my box. Like, I'm mm-hmm. good.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And it's not really about that.
Yeah.
It's like, when I was applying for the Senate job, I also had applied to a bunch of places, including a very large company, local in town here. And I'll just call them out. It was Best Buy. I was applying to Best Buy. And this recruiter was like, you know, like really, really nice to me. And then I was like, hey, I got another job. Thanks for your interest. Blah, blah, blah. And he got like super mean and like sent me a whole bunch of emails about like how awful I was because I like was hurting his diversity quota numbers.
Oh, wow.
It's like, okay.
Right. Oh, boy, that's.
You're not getting the point of those.
Yeah. For real. Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, you're motivated. I mean, like,
yeah.
Like maybe that guy won't learn his lesson, but like making him do it. Like, even if he doesn't have the right motivation, although someone should teach him. Like,
right.
that's the problem. It's like, the issue is so multidimensional. It's mm-hmm. like, you feel like any progress is good progress, but like, no progress is progress enough.
Oh, sure.
And so it's really hard to tell anybody good job.
Yeah.
Because almost nothing they do is good enough. Nothing any of us do is good enough.
Well, yeah.
The bare minimums that people do that feel big shouldn't be as rewarded, but then you got to reward them or else people aren't going to make any more progress.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. This is a complicated topic. You're absolutely right about that. Like there's a lot of things. The thing is also you can't be all things for all people. You can't like make this thing the end all be all zeitgeist amazing thing that contains literally all representation of all people in all the world, because that is not possible. There are 7 billion of us, and we're all different. So you cannot do that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is a topic that I argue with my brother about a lot.
Yeah, argue in McGregor means just discuss.
Yeah. Right. I tend to be compared to my brother, I tend to be a stronger proponent of representation and things. Mm-hmm. Where my brother, like, he just wants to make games, like HyperDot game. He's always saying, I just want to make a game about a dot.
He doesn't want the weight of it on.
Yeah, he doesn't want the weight of it on.
Yeah,
and like and I totally understand that perspective too, because like he shouldn't have the weight of all of that on him. But also at the same time, I'm a little bit like, but Charles, you could do more with it, and you know, you could help us. But he shouldn't have to. He shouldn't be forced to do it. That shouldn't be on him. It shouldn't be his responsibility. So it's a complicated thing, because like not all the stories I make are going to be about black people. I'm making ones about fish and ferrets right now, and that's fine. It's a complicated topic. It's not really something we can answer, but it's just something I wanted to bring to the table. Something I wanted to discuss.
I do like when we touch on these topics in the show generally. It was nice to devote a whole topic to it.
Yeah.
And I hopefully listeners appreciate it as well. And I hope that we keep coming back to it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I do want to bring up before we end a couple of things that you can avoid. Are things that like are pretty easy to avoid right away. Mm-hmm. So like stereotypes, for example, like not all black people are boxers in fighting games. That's how it always seems to be. It's like black people are boxers. I don't know why that is stereotype, but like those kinds of things, try to stay away from those kinds of things. And then painting over characters, you know, just like changing the character's gender, ethnicity, just because you want for representation, like we brought up before. Just think about why you're doing that before you do it. And also generalizing a group of people. Like we said, not one person does not represent an entire race or an entire gender or such. So, you know, just make sure not to do those kinds of things. Just be careful about your creative process. Think about what you're doing. Like all of the decisions you make in your game are important. So keep that in mind.
And think about the different contexts that those individual pieces are going into, because like one part could be not racist or not sexist, but then when you put it in context with the other thing,
it's oops. Bad.
Yeah. Oops, I'm a racist.
Yep.
And I think if you find yourself not knowing where it is, I think looking for help and for advice and feedback is helpful.
Yeah.
If, you know, you're the artist, so it's on you, which means you get to decide. So you can't take your diversity consultant's advice and do it and then say, well, they just said it was fine.
Yeah.
Like that doesn't absolve you.
Right.
You need to do the work, and that your diversity consultant is not responsible for making your game diverse.
Yeah.
You are. Mm-hmm. Also when you think about these issues, like, do you want to make part of your game comment on them? And I think that's an even greater task ahead of you if you want.
Yeah.
But it's not something you should shy away from if it's something that you're leaning towards.
Yeah. Yeah. So, totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Be daring, but careful.
Mm-hmm. That's good. That's a good note. I like that.
Well, Stephen, thank you for outlining this one for us.
Yeah.
This
no problem. Good.
That's our show. If you haven't already, subscribe to Nice Games Club in your favorite podcast app and be sure to give it a good review if you liked it or are nice like us. We really need to know you're out there, so leave a good review and tell your friends too. We also want to hear directly from you, so follow us on Twitter and all the other things at Nice Games Club and email us at contact@nicegames.club. Lastly, you can find more about the show, your nice hosts, as well as get all the links and show notes from this and other episodes at nicegames.club.
So until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.